This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9-1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball. We have done probably well over 700 or 800 episodes. We've never had a Red Sox player on our podcast until tonight. And the first player, maybe the only player for quite a while, is Jonathan Papelbon, my favorite player of all time. 2007, one of my favorite seasons of all time. And so glad to have you on with us, man.
Yeah, what's up, fellas? It's good to be on tonight. You know, well, except for Charles, I don't know where the hell he's at. Like, it looks like it's daylight.
It is daylight out here. I'm in Los Angeles.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. So when you come out here, just let me know.
We'll grab well, we're on the better, we're on the better coast, the East Coast.
No, there it is.
Yeah. So are you in Boston right now?
No, I'm actually in Mississippi right now.
You're in Mississippi. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Is that where you're from? I thought you were from Texas.
No, I'm originally from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Went to Florida, then decided to stay in Mississippi.
Gotcha.
Right on.
Okay.
Cool.
And I'm in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, originally from Maine. And Charlie's actually originally from Providence. So we are New England born. So, all right, Charlie, let's just hit the ground running.
Absolutely. You know, Terry, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. You know, Terry mentioned he was one of your favorite players. You are like one of my spirit animal Red Sox players. I'm so excited to have you here. Very blessed to have you here. So the first question that we have for you, everyone knows about your 2007 ALCS Papelbon jig dance. Which of your former teammates had the best dance moves outside of yours?
Man, you know, that's a good question. Actually, I'm going to go with my Hebrew boy, Kevin Euclid, man.
Okay.
You know they can get crazy at the bar mitzvahs. You know, you got to watch out. They're sneaky good dancers, man. So, yeah, he was usually out on the field with me celebrating, man. So, I got to go with my boy, Uke.
That's amazing.
That was, like, basically, to me, the most iconic moment of that season was, and I think it was the final game of that series when you guys were all out there. Just one of my favorite celebrations of all time. We had win, dance, repeat later on with Mookie, Benintendi, and Bradley, but that was, like, nothing compared to
well, you know, they tried to give us like some kind of rule we couldn't celebrate on the field after that, but we were like, to hell with that, you know.
Yeah. And that's what I loved about you guys. You guys were like the most authentic crew ever. I guess 04 too, but it's just like players just they play it safe these days, and they're that type of authenticity just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, you know, I've had a real problem with it when I left the game. Actually, when I left, man, I was like, this game's not for me anymore. But, you know, the game evolves, and now kids are more worried about, you know, the home run dance or the trot or the handshake, you know. Back then, we were more worried about, you know, coming to your town, kicking your ass, and drinking your beer. You know, that's all we were worried about.
Yeah.
We weren't worried about nothing else. You know, Big Poppy did his thing, but, you know, it's nothing compared to what it is nowadays.
And I miss that so much. So Terry Francona, in my opinion, is the greatest manager of the 21st century. Would you agree with that, having played for him?
21st century, I guess. How long does that go back? Let's see. To the
last 23 years.
Yeah, 80s. We're talking 80. Yeah, so I'm
you
trying
can
to
go
do
back
the math
that far.
Here. So, there's been a lot of good managers. Don't get me wrong. I think Terry Francona was a pioneer of become. I will give him this. He was the pioneer of becoming the manager that knew the pulse on the team and the team psychiatrist. I mean, that's that's what he. I can promise you this: on the 2004, 2007, 8, 9, all the way through, he was a psychiatrist, man, and he knew how to get the best out of his player, and he knew how to also, you know, approach that player and deal with that player, and whether it was Manny and him having a bench man. Man, look, when you bench a guy like Manny Ramirez, everybody else follows in suit. They follow along, you know. You know, nowadays, you don't necessarily see that happening either. But, yeah, he's definitely one of the top, for sure.
Actually, I'm going to go out of order here, Charlie, since he brought up Manny. I was going to ask you, what was it like to be his teammate? Because he's another guy where there's no player like him.
Yeah, you know – There was a few different Mannies you had to deal with, you know. But you and it was, you know, you never quite knew what you were going to get, you know. But at the end of the day, you knew he was going to post up every day. He posted every day, man. And, you know, he helped us win. And, you know, whether it's Kevin Youkilis getting into an argument with him in the bench that one day, or, you know, me behind the scenes, everybody else behind, you know, you have all these egos in a clubhouse, man, and it's hard to get 25 major egos to all mesh. It's just, and but when you do, boy, you have a secret recipe. If somehow we were all able to mesh, and I think that was a culture that we created, man. And, you know, now being with Nesson, man, it's like, shit, we can't lose this culture, man. Y'all don't let it go. And, you know, that's one of the things I stress. And, you know, I know to let Bloom go now. And I think, you know, my gut tells me Hazen. I'm not in the front office. Don't quote me on that. I'm just giving you what Papelbon's gut feels like. I think he knows the culture of this team. I think he knows what to expect here. He knows what he's signing up for. You don't win a pennant or a World Series, go home. And I think he'll do a good job, but that's to be seen.
I heard Brunson Arroyo tell a Manny story once, and Arroyo, apparently it was his ritual to take a quick power nap before every game. And one day he was starting, he takes his nap, he wakes up, and Manny is spooning him. Does that sound like a day in the, you know, the Red Sox?
That is a very, very calm and easy day with what was going on. You know, that's the thing. Manny could be spooning you on the couch or coming after you with a bat. You never know.
I mean, that's incredible.
But you know what? We once you step foot in that clubhouse, we were a brotherhood. We were and, you know, brothers fight and brothers get through things and brothers win championships. It's just kind of like me and my brothers in the house, you know. Yeah.
Totally fair. With that being said, since we're talking about a little bit of the past, was there a player in the batter's box that you wanted to strike out every single time you saw them?
No question, Alex Rodriguez. I mean,
yes, thank you.
I mean,
oh my God, yeah.
There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If you know, there were times where I had to throw in, and if it hit him, it hit him, and I wanted to strike him out. Those were my two options there. But you know, he was a great hitter. You can't take anything away from him. But he was that Yankee that I just wanted to pummel. You know, Derek Jeter you know, he'd get a little bloop hit over first baseman or something. I just wanted him, you know. I don't know.
That was a very satisfying answer. Ryan Dempster famously plunked him when he came back from a suspension. And the cool thing about that was it was in September 2013, so right before another World Series. It was just kind of one of those moments that just kind of fired up the team a little bit. 2018, we had Joe Kelly, you know, and
it never gets old, whether it's Joe Kelly, Dimp, or A-Rod, getting his ass kicked by Tech, you know. Yeah, I mean, it never gets old, man, you know.
And that actually kind of leads me in. You're like giving us the perfect cue. So was Tech the best?
Yeah, good segue. I learned how to do segues on Nesson.
Okay. Well, we're
you're bossing it right now.
Far more amateur than that we are. I mean, so Jason Veritek, was he the best catcher you ever had in your career?
Yeah, no question. For me, no question. For me, it was a no-brainer. You know, speaking of Tech, I mean, there were times where Tech was my uncle, my older brother, and there were times where he, you know, I mean, a chokehold in the clubhouse. Like, please let go. I need a pitch tonight. You know? But, you know, he taught me how to be a man. He taught me how to create an ownership for myself and be my own coach and my own individual, my own person, and learn how to pitch that way. And, you know, I mean, I went to him for thousands of bits of advice, you know, even when I was like, hey, a starter or a closer, Tech. And he was like, hey, man, listen, you're going to be good at both. It'll be great. But you do what that heart desires, and you're going to have a healthy and strong career, and you're going to do what you love. And so I chose that way. But just little things like that, you know, you could always go to him. And I never forget one time, Phil was throwing a no hitter, 8 2/3 in Oakland, and he didn't shake off Veritek the entire game. Last hitter that comes up, he shakes him. What happens? Base hit. And Curt Schilling undeniably comes into the dugout, and he's like, I don't shake. What the fuck was I doing? I don't shake off the best damn catcher in baseball. And you know, everybody was like, yeah, you dumbass, what were you doing? You know, like, wow. You just threw 8 2/3 shut piece and you just shook him. Like, what? Huh?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. You know, Terry talked about something where he said, you know, you got the segue thing down. Literally, you've got everything lined up. It's like you've got our playbook here. As a former starter turned elite closer, what advice would you give a pitcher in the Boston Red Sox organization, or any organization for that matter? This, like, what advice would you give to someone facing that same situation, moving from a starter to a closer or a reliever?
Well, look, at the end of the day, I think you find your niche. You don't necessarily may find that in the beginning. I mean, look, you got like Houck, Whitlock. I mean, you go, you know, all these guys, they don't start a reliever, you know, Cutter Crawford, start a reliever. You know, everybody's, you know, but at the end of the day, a lot of times the team that's built around you will decide that. But for me, in my situation, it was more like I'm starting and I don't know if I was like too ADD enough or what, man, but I could not sit on the bench for 5 days. It drove me nuts, man. And so I wanted to play every day I could. And I knew that. And then we were in the spring training. '06. We were in spring training. And Francona and Theo at the time were like, yeah, you're going to start this year. I'm like, man, I really don't want to start. I think I could be a good reliever, because I was a reliever in the bullpen in 05 when we were in the playoffs. We got beat by the White Sox, and I felt good. But anyway, long story short, they're like, nah, you're starting, Pap. I'm like, nah, I don't want to start. Like, Pap, you're starting. I was like, all right, how y'all make them? You know, I'm in the office with Theo and Tito. I'm like, hey, y'all make a deal. If we don't have a closer by a week or two left of spring training, and in hindsight, I knew what we had in the bullpen, so I knew I could close, right? And I knew what was going to happen, really. And so I said, if you can't find a closer by the end of spring training, you got to give it to me. It's done. Like, I'm not starting. He said, that's a deal. Well, the week into it, I stroll into his office. And I rode a motorcycle back then. Theo was like, number one, get off the damn motorcycle. Number two, you're our closer. Are you happy? And I was like, yeah, I'm happy. And so... Yeah, and then that's kind of how it worked, man.
Is there a young pitcher right now, currently in the Red Sox organization, that you think could be the next great closer? Have you identified anyone?
No.
Okay.
They don't have anybody. No. Right now, you know, I know Greenville. I think Greenville just won their that they won a league. There's some talent in the minor leagues, but I don't know. And it's different now because they play the role and the leverage innings different. You know, I know they have Kinley still in a traditional closer's role, but I don't know about that. I mean, like, I don't see anybody coming up, you know, here soon. No, I don't.
I was just wondering about Hauk. I was wondering if you might throw his name out there. I just like his poise. And there's been this debate for 2 years. Is he a starter? Is he a reliever? You know, he has trouble going past the second time of the order. And I think we need at least two starting pitchers this year from the free agent market or trade.
No question.
So I just, maybe we don't have the luxury.
No question.
Yeah.
No question. Look, whoever comes in here, y'all see my baby girl?
Oh, yeah.
Say hi.
Hello. How are you?
So whoever comes in here next, man, there is no question about it, period. In the discussion, the first matter at hand is two starting pitchers. If you do not go out and get any starting pitching, you're going to see the same effects as you did this season, where your bullpen throws more innings than anyone in the major leagues, and then your starters go out with a knee here or, you know, shoulder here for a couple weeks, then you tax them even more. Look, their lineup, I feel like their lineup is fine. Like that, like, and they can input some little piece here or there, but all of their offseason acquisitions need to be 80% into the bullpen or the starting staff. And, you know, you got JT coming back. You got Duran coming back, who I like. The Raphael kid, who knows if he's going to play infield or outfield. I don't know, but we'll see. So, you know, to me, this is – if I'm the GM, this is not a rebuild. This is not a rebuild. This is a reload. You have enough to reload, not have to start over and rebuild.
Right. I think it's really important to look at it from that perspective too. You know, before the year started, I remember like our podcast got destroyed by some of the listeners and people and out there, because we said we're still missing people. We're still missing, like, starting pitching is not a position of depth. Like, I've been using that term very regularly because we've been getting hammered as far as our rotation is concerned. People going down, people not coming back, people still not able to go 2-3 times through the rotation and whatnot. So I'm 100% with you.
They got to win 4 more games to hit their over mark of 78.5 wins this year.
I said that, 78 was going to be the number this year.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. But I don't think it's going to happen.
We got three against Chicago, so that they're going to give you your best chance. Right. But having played under, having seen how the whole Bloom regime played out, are you thankful that you were in the Epstein regime where he just always seemed to kind of give you guys what you needed to be competitive?
No question. And Bloom's biggest mistake to me was at the trade deadline, when you are right in the thick of it, no questions asked, and all you need to do is go make a – go. You had Giolito. You had so many starting pitchers you could have went out and got at the deadline, and you do nothing, and then you call your team underdogs. Man, if I'm in that clubhouse – look, I've been in the clubhouse. It's different now. The GMs are always in there. I mean, I've been in there when Theo would walk in and Kevin Millar would be like, Theo, what are you doing in our club? Get the hell out of here. You know, like, it, like, just like, I would make a phone call. There would be 25 guys wanting to know why the hell you said that about our team. You know what I mean? It just does, it never sat well. I know it didn't sit well with me, so I know it didn't sit well with them. So, you can't, like I said, it's a culture here in Boston. And if you're not part of that culture of, you know, get rich or die trying, or win at all costs, or, you know, go out there and post up every night, man, people in Boston don't give a shit about the guy that barely plays. They don't give a shit about, you know, the guy that's always hurt. They want their Pedroias. They want their guys that post up, man. They want gamers. They don't want babies, man. That's how it is. And that's what you sign up for.
So you definitely think the trade deadline was the turning point? Like there was just no
question.
Yeah. Okay.
No question about it.
We weren't a Heim Bloom podcast, and the moment he signed Kluber was it for me. I was like, we're not going to be competitive. I thought we were going to, my number was 74 wins. Charlie went a little above me with 78. We got six guys on our crew. Some of them were in the low 80s, but none of us had them into the playoffs. And you mentioned Hazen, like you really think, cause I, from the outside looking in, and you're way more, you talk to way higher up people than we do, but I just think,
man, all I talk to is Jim Rice, man. Come on. He ain't that.
But he's a great guy to talk to.
I had to get him, you know.
We're off the tracks compared to what our plan was, but that's fine. We're good with it. I'm so entertained by Darnell McDonald. I don't know what it is. It's his awkward disposition, but I've never watching you guys on the post game, whatever combination it is just so entertaining.
Yeah, you know, I think we got a good mix going there at the crew. Hopefully we can keep it going. But the thing that I like best about all of them, and even Tom Karen, man, it's everyone there holds that culture very dear to their heart. I mean, they live and die at Nesson. The Red Sox own them. I mean, nobody in that organization was happy about, you know, being in last place four out of the five last year, or second or last. I'm sorry. One of the two. And to me, you know, I mean, it just, that culture cannot exist for, you know, that long. You got to get rid of that. So,
right.
It seemed like that winter weekend where I don't know if you followed it, but they were, you know, meeting and greeting the fans at either Foxwoods or Mohegan, and it just turned into this angry mob against Bloom, and they just completely lost control of everything. And Bloom was like kind of defiantly defending all his moves up to that point. And the thing was, the team had been assembled by that point. I think maybe the only thing that hadn't been addressed was Story's injury and then Adam Duvall coming in. But it was just, man, it was a shit show the whole year.
Yeah, there's no question about it. But, you know, the good thing about John and Linda Henry, you know, your principal owners, I know one damn thing. Linda's face is all over that stadium. John's a very active owner, and he gives them enough payroll to win. I will say that much. If you can't win with over $200 million, and you don't believe. So at the end of the day, they want to win. And they're not going to stand for being at the bottom of the barrel. And that you got to respect that. And when you're a GM, you know what you sign up for when you come here.
I fight the pro Bloom guys. We call them the Bloominati. And that's what they are, man. And they all theorize that Bloom had all these mandates. He couldn't spend. He couldn't be aggressive. And do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with it. I know.
Okay.
That's false.
Okay.
There's no disagreement there to be had. The fact is the fact. Don Browski got the same thing. That's all bullshit.
I agree. That's how I felt about it. I mean, he was over the tax last year, so.
Yeah, come on.
Right.
So I didn't.
Now I see why you call him the Bloominati. Okay.
Yeah, and those people before the start of every season, they would praise Bloom for everything he did and express extreme optimism that we're making the playoffs. And it was only in September when that clearly wasn't going to happen, or August even. Then it was ownership's fault. So I'm just so glad, you know, it was a huge W for us. Bloom getting fired was the best day in the existence of this podcast, aside from 2018, which was like our second year. So anyway, Charlie.
Yeah, well, it was funny that I was, you know, we were there when I was doing this, and I was on the show when he got fired. And it was like, I walked from the Hotel Commonwealth to Fenway, and it was, you know, everybody was just like jumping for joy because, you know, they felt like, okay, now we could change this culture and we get this guy out of here and start to reload, like I said, not rebuild. And, you know, I think there was an exult in the city, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it was a huge relief that it finally happened. I mean, I'm a little stressed out now because I feel like we got way too many lefties. You got four lefties in your outfield. You've got, you know, you have a definite need for pitching.
Yeah, you nailed it, right? So, okay. So what you're going to have to do with that overload of what you're talking about is now, so not only are they going to have to be the free agent acquisitions, but you got to do the next guy that comes in is going to have to do some nifty trading, some good trades too, you know? So that's going to be part of the equation. No doubt about it, Terrence.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cleaning up to do, and fine tuning. And I love Willier Abreu. I kind of hope he's a part of the future.
Hey, I like that. It's a good call, man. I was saying that on Nesson, you know. I was saying, hey, this guy's got a professional – man, he's got a good approach. He's got a – he knows the strike zone. Well, it's I think he said he's got a professional style bat. He's not free swing. He's not like a normal minor leaguer that comes up. Is that what I'm saying?
He's got good plate discipline.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Got good plate discipline. Yeah. So some things you don't necessarily see, you know.
Right. And you mentioned Duran. We're kind of split on what we should do. I'm a huge proponent of keeping him. I mean, it's
Duran.
Go ahead.
We're going to keep Duran. So this is what I if I'm, you know, looking at my crystal ball, I say you go out and, you know, Duran has a good year. You know, hey, man, if you can make a good trade for him and get something you really need, and you got like a backup outfielder, man, you got to strike while the iron's hot, man. Like in the game of baseball, it's like the stock market, man. That shit goes up and down. Guys go up and down, you know?
Right.
I mean, I'm playing fantasy football. Guess who I have on my team?
I'm guessing by that comment, you might have struck out with Nick Chubb or Saquon.
Yeah. I got both of them.
I'm sorry for your loss. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what my point is, right? So,
yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
When you got that opportunity, and that's the tricky part of that GM role. And sometimes it can make or break, you know?
Right.
I get what you're saying. You want to sell while his value is the highest it's ever been.
So, Terrence, you like Duran.
I'm a Duran guy. I just feel like he reminds me a lot of Ellsbury. Ellsbury would draw more walks, but you can't even – he was hitting 400 for a couple of months, and obviously that's not who he's going to be forever, but he could turn a walk into a double by automatically stealing second. And I just felt like, you know, the opposing pitcher on the mound and all the infielders behind him, their anxiety level would just go through the roof as soon as Duran got to first. And
I like that. Yeah,
that's just what's so. But like I said, I mean, you might have to. And everybody's the Bluminati are saying, oh, the next guy's going to come in and trade your prospects. But you got so much depth at the major league level that you can trade. Yeah. I mean, Duran could be one of them. Secretly, right. I've only mentioned this on the last couple of shows. I wouldn't mind if they traded Yoshida. I love Yoshida, but, you know, Raffy's a potential future DH. Casas might need to do some DH from time to time. Yeah, and I mean, Otani's a future DH, not saying we're going to go there. We all want Yamamoto. Who do you like between those two, Yamamoto or Otani?
I got to go with Yamamoto.
Yes,
man,
yes. That's who exactly who we all wanted.
You know, man, two Tommy John surgeries, I don't care. And I know Otani can hit, but hit – okay, and the reason why I say this is two Tommy John surgeries, that's tough to come back from. Not many people do that.
Right.
And be themselves, number one. And then, so that resorts to just him hitting a lot more. And you get older as a hitter quicker than you do as a pitcher. And so give me the young Japanese guy that throws two hitters already. I don't know.
And he's only 25. So, yeah.
A huge age difference, too.
Yeah.
You know, you were talking, Jonathan, you were talking. Do you prefer John or Jonathan? What do you prefer?
Either or, man.
All right, cool. So, John, I want to make sure I don't upset you. So, you know, we're talking about some of the things that we wish would have been different and we wish could have been changed. And you just shared that it wasn't a rumor. It's a fact. Like we could have purchased some other players and made this team better for 2023. During your time as a ball player, was there anything, if you could do anything over again, is there anything that you would have done differently? One thing, what's the one thing you might have done differently?
I would have gone to bed earlier every night.
I respect that so much. What, I respect that.
Did you just
That's
see what
answer.
Came out with Yusei Kikuchi? He left the game with cramps, and he said that he only got 11 hours of sleep, but he normally gets 13 or 14.
I don't buy that for
what?
A second.
That's all over
there's
Twitter
no
right now. Yeah, he normally
no chill way.
Hey, I'm going to go on record again and say there's no chance of that.
I know, exactly. It's just like the most extreme thing I've ever heard. All right. Well, we won't keep you, but I got to tell you this one thing. I'm a card player, and I love Texas Hold'em, and I like cribbage. And you must know what cribbage is from being in the clubhouse with Tito and Francona.
Oh, I think I'm
going to give you a little tour of this right here.
Okay. Oh, it's a Texas Hold'em table.
I love this.
Oh,
my goodness.
He's got a casino.
Yeah.
Craps, blackjack table.
So you're talking my language now.
All right. And okay. So I had a Jonathan Papelbon. It was just a regular t-shirt, Red Sox on the front, Papelbon number 58 on the back. And I'd been, it seemed to be lucky when I was playing these Texas Hold'em games. And
you're damn right it was.
I'm a bigger cribbage guy though. I play at the national level. Okay. It's kind of nerdy. I had a big tournament. I said, you know what? I'm bringing my Papelbon shirt. I'm wearing it. I walk in, I pay my entry fee, I have to draw a seat number. I drew seat number 58.
58.
How
yeah,
epic is
dude.
That? How
it was it was
that?
Just random. Yeah. I had to pull it out of a cup. It was the most random thing ever. And then 8 hours later, after 106 players, I won the tournament. It was my second win ever.
You're damn right, you won that tournament.
Exactly.
Hell yeah.
I wore that shirt so much when I played cards, you couldn't even see the number or the name on the back anymore.
That is so awesome, man.
I know. And so I couldn't believe it. But I tell that story all the time at tournaments and so
Well, look, man, next time we do anything at the Encore, man, or we have a charity tournament, man, I'll be sure to invite you.
Okay, man. That would be great. I'll do Texas Hold'em too.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
all right, guys.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for being the greatest closer of my lifetime. And thank you for 2007.
Charles, it's good to talk to y'all, man. Best of luck, man. I'll be around.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.